Nick Payne's family drama set against a backdrop of global warming with the provocative title, If There Is, I Haven't Found It Yet, won raves from critics when it premiered in London 3 years ago. It's now being staged by the Roundabout Theater with Jake Gyllenhaal and Brian F. O'Byrne playing brothers. It has just been extended 2 weeks at the Roundtable's Laura Pels Theater on West 46th Street, and I'm very pleased that it has brought the two stars to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Jake, you've been in many films. You were nominated for an Oscar for Brokeback Mountain, but isn't this your New York stage debut?
It is, yeah. I was on stage in the West End in London a few years back, but this is the first time I have had the pleasure to be on stage and the honor to be on stage in New York City.
You were in Kenneth Lonergan's This Is Our Youth. Did you see this play at the time, or was it running at the same time?
No, this was we did This Is Our Youth over on the West End years before this play had been staged, and maybe even before Nick had even conjured it up in his mind. I have the pleasure of being older than the playwright, which is one of the first times in my career.
Well, reviews have been impressed with your ease on stage. New York Magazine called you a stage actor of innate instinct, which is not always the case when film actors cross over into theater. Had you done a lot of stage work when you were studying?
I didn't study formally, I guess you could say. So, but I did grow up on the stage in different productions, be it in high school and actually outside of that. And it was somewhere where I always felt great comfort in a strange way.
Well, your mother was involved in theater, wasn't she?
She wasn't. She was a producer for Sesame Street for a number of years. I think that's the closest that she got to stage work herself. But she's a screenwriter, and she wrote movies. So,
your father was a director.
My father's is a director. He was a film director as well. And my sister and I were on stage since we were young kids. And we, in a way, the dinner table was a stage as well. So, you know, though I'm in New York on stage, I sort of sometimes think to myself, this is exactly as it was when we were growing up around the dinner table.
Now, Brian, New York theatergoers will remember you as the priest in Doubt and the killer in Frozen, for which you won a Tony. You were in The Coast of Utopia. TV, of course, Bert Pierce and HBO's Mildred Pierce. Here you play George, a college professor who's writing a book about global warming. Can you tell us a bit about George?
Yeah, I can. I guess the play has, like most good plays, have got several different stories running at once. One is one of the central characters is an overweight teenager who's
played it magnificently,
beautifully played by Annie Funke.
Annie Funke.
Yeah, beautifully in her first so-called straight play. She's done musicals before, but she gives an astonishing, revealing performance in lots of ways, and. I play her dad, who is writing a book about global warming, and his dedication to this book and his belief that the world has to wake up to this impending danger, and he neglects his own family.
It's one of those things where somebody wants to save the planet but is oblivious to what's going on in his own home.
Well, I think he does know that things are going on at home, as most of us, as a lot of us do in life. We know that things might not be quite correct, but we put it off until next week.
Well, as you mentioned, Anna is overweight. She's being bullied at school, and when she fights back, she's suspended. And how does George react to that?
Well, he reacts as most busy people do and says, I'll deal with it very shortly, and can somebody else just take care of this right now? And thankfully, or maybe not so thankfully, his brother, played by Jake, has arrived at the time and is available to do, in one sense, babysitting.
So what can you tell us about Terry, Jake? He's a kind of a ne'er-do-well. And we figured that out right away.
Well, yeah. I mean, at his entrance, he walks in with a backpack, having been well worn from traveling. So I think it's pretty clear. Maybe also hinted by our facial hair, but yet.
The Brian, both of you grew Brian, beards for this play.
And I,
we did, yeah.
Yeah, unconsciously, I think. I don't think that was.
That really wasn't in the script.
No.
The three of us right now. It's too bad this isn't. We can't see it, Leonard. But the three
it's
of
true.
Us are.
We're all sporting different lengths.
Yeah, well, mine is rather close cropped. Yours are very impressive.
Thank you very much. We take pride in our
If only you come
for that one reason. Beard fans, yes, please, yes, visit our play.
All Beard fans. Yeah, well, Terry arrives and he's been traveling around the world, or so he says. He's come back after having done some pretty strange things before he left. So he sort of left and abandoned, just like his brother, you know, abandoned a number of things, expecting to come back and having it sort of be cleared up and it'd be okay. Though he's aware that there's stuff at stake. And
well, this is a very middle-class family, and mm-hmm. he's a drifter, and he even has a lower-class accent than the rest of the family.
Yeah, well, his effort, I think, is a middle-class kid trying to sort of put on a little bit more street, you know, and I think that gives him away immediately, you know, and he even says, the first line of the play is, you know, people think that we're not brothers because we sound so different. You know,
please don't quote too many of the other lines you say, because I'll get in trouble with the FCC. But you do a very convincing British accent. Does that come naturally to you?
I think it was a mixture of Nick's writing and I think the rhythm of his writing, which really leads you into the accent itself. And then I also think, yeah, I like to impersonate, and it's something I would consider probably one of my strengths in a way. But the character itself was at first probably developed years and years ago as a caricature, and then through Nick's writing and through sort of honing in on it became more subtle and then became a real accent.
Well, we assume, Brian, that you can do a British accent because you're Irish, but you have to adjust as well, don't you?
Yes, I hope I do. Yeah, I do. You know, that's just part of the deal with acting. Now,
but
you know, everybody expects everybody to be brilliant because of basically Miss Streep. Everyone on the planet believes every actor has
she's
to be astonishingly
raised the bar
good
too high
at doing accents. I mean, if you look at older movies and stuff like that, or even clips from older plays, it's kind of astonishing what people got away with before.
It's true.
And also we have the strange thing where there's becoming, in some ways, a homogenization of accents around the world. So the more specific you get, in some ways, it can be more jarring for listeners as well. So it's a funny old game.
But I have noticed that it works both ways. British actors are doing American accents a lot better than they did in the past. I remember Olivier doing a very rather bad American accent in a production of Death of a Salesman. But today, it's really hard to tell where actors come from. I guess, is it acting coaches?
I think also
language
people
coaches?
Grow up with the media available all the time. I mean, growing up in Ireland, just after I was of the age, people now across the world look at American TV all the time.
Well, could this play have been done in an American accent, or does the language dictate that it needs to be in
the language? No, without a doubt, dictates.
And it's because there are various class things inherent in the play, and avoidance. Both our British playwright and British director were both, and from there, they wanted to put this forward. They wanted this British notion of not dealing with feelings underneath, that we never talk about anything, to skim along the surface, which they believed was very British.
And when Anna is suspended from school, Terry is the only one who really befriends her, since her parents don't seem to be able to deal with her problems. Mother's a school teacher, possibly because he seems to have never grown up himself.
I think there's that, and I think he has his own agenda as well, which is if he takes care of her, then he might get in better with her parents, and then eventually he's also, which you discover later on, that he's really come back to go see this woman that he's been in love with and who he has done some, I don't know, has, how would you describe it, Brian? I think has behaved in ways in which she's sort of avoiding him, and so he's come back to really see her. This woman, Rachel, and he figures that if he can get in good with Anna at first, and then he'll get in good with her parents, his brother and his brother's wife, and then hopefully to Rachel. And what ends up happening ultimately, I think, is that the relationship that he cares about the most is the one with his niece.
Brian, you have a painful scene with Anna in a restaurant that many parents of teenagers will relate to.
Well, I'm glad that you feel that. Yeah, he has to give advice about life with somebody who he realizes he hasn't really spoken to for a number of years in any real way, and he's forced then to have a talk about a date that went horribly wrong. He doesn't understand what actually happened on the date with her, and he's forced to try and reconnect with a sullen teenager.
But she can tell Terry a lot more about what happened on that date than she can tell her own parents.
Yeah, absolutely. She doesn't, she treats Terry as, he becomes almost like a brother figure in a way. And
or perhaps something else.
Yeah, perhaps something.
Yeah, we don't want to go into reveal too much.
Into other areas. But I think they're also their sense, at least we talked about this, Annie and I think their sense of being misunderstood, but their sense of similar type of anger, I think, and a similar type of inability to express themselves really does bring the two of them together. And then the intimacy becomes confusing, as I think you were alluding to.
Yeah. How old is Annie Funk? Because she is a very convincing 16-year-old.
She's 27 years old.
Oh, my.
Yeah. I think what makes it wonderful is I've had some teenagers or late teenagers say that they thought she was the same age as them.
When I'm on stage with her, there are some things that happen, and people come off stage and they'll go, "That was so hard for me to watch you have an exchange with a 15-year-old like that." And I go, "It's so different on stage, obviously, because to me, Annie really does seem 27, and yet on stage, I think she plays, particularly in this part, she's so convincing as a 15-year-old. It's extraordinary."
My guests are Jake Gyllenhaal and Brian F. O'Byrne, who are two of the stars, along with Annie Funk and also Michelle Gomez, Michelle's just leaving. Yeah, I saw Michelle in it.
We have Enid Graham coming in from tonight for her first show.
A new production of If There Is, I Haven't Found It Yet, by the very hot young British playwright Nick Payne. And it's at the Laura Pels Theater on West 45th Street. 46th Street, right off of 6th Avenue, mm-hmm. A wonderful little theater. Must be great to play in that theater it's big enough and yet it's small enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's exactly how it feels, yeah.
The staging is very unusual. When the play opens, there's a huge pile of furniture in the middle of the stage, and the actors take what they need for each scene and then throw the item into a water tank at the front of the stage. Was that in the script, or is that something the director, Michael Longhurst, and the set designer, Beowulf Barrett, devised for this production?
Yeah, when we read it, the play was actually, I believe it was, it may have actually been commissioned, and it was written for a very intimate 50-seat theater, where the scenes, people would sit in, essentially in the room with these four characters. And so it was very intimate, and the dialogue, as you've witnessed, is very naturalistic. And so it was a very small play. Well, obviously, you come to a theater, the Laura Pels is a bigger space. The director didn't want to go back to that route, so he thought, well, how do we literally explode the thing a little bit more? And in discussion with Beowulf came with this wonderful idea of literally just blow the whole thing out, and we bring 3,500 gallons of water and a large pile of furniture to this very intimate play.
Well, that pile looked rather precarious at first. Does moving all that furniture around require precise choreography? If you pull out a piece in the wrong order, might the whole thing just topple over?
Yes, it is very possible, particularly towards the beginning, because there's so many things on top of one another. But there's one point where I'm on top of a refrigerator and I have to climb over what is the table that in the Indian restaurant scene that Brian and Annie have much later on in the show. And every time I climb over it, I think, if I knock this over, that's the end of the Indian food. And there was, in previews, there was actual Indian food waiting there, which they've since taken out. But there was actual food there. So it was even more precarious and more of a risk, because you drop Indian food into the bathtub that Annie then has a massive scene in the play on her own in. So that would have been quite a mess.
It would have been a different scene if she was sitting into a bath full of Indian food.
But it also might have been scary. You're sitting on top of that refrigerator. You open the refrigerator. You take something out of it.
Yeah.
You try to put something back into it.
Yeah.
That has to be very precarious as well.
There are many nights
you don't get a stunt double? For a movie, you would.
Not on an off-Broadway show, you don't.
Yeah, well, you know, there are many things that can fly out and do fly out of that refrigerator when I turn it around and knock it over. And it always makes for an interesting evening, knowing or not knowing what might fall out of that fridge. And good comedy when need be.
You know, and of course, the purpose behind the whole thing is Beowulf. One of the reasons is why the set is designed in that way and we discard stuff is the kind of metaphor for how we all discard stuff through life and actually the reality of how we just use things and throw them away and don't pay any attention to where they end up.
And Jim, geographically, geometrically, it's all been designed so that, you know, a lot of the things I place out on onto the stage, and they do get thrown into the trough, particularly at the beginning, and there are exact marks depending on where they go so that they do land in the trough, because we throw them in a very specific way every night.
Well, you mentioned water is also a theme in the play. A curtain of rain is falling as the audience enters the theater, and at a certain point in the play, the actors are wading ankle deep in water. Some critics have worried that you'll all get colds.
We all do have colds, but I don't think it's anything got to do with having young children.
I like
at school,
critics are worried that we're going to get colds. I appreciate that.
I didn't understand critics had hearts like that. They would have empathy towards.
Do you think the water represents connects it to the global warming thing?
Yeah, I mean, when you have this person who's worrying about, specifically says what's going to happen when our planet is going to just have one polar ice cap and what's going to happen when the Greenland ice sheet melts, and he's delivering these lines wading in water.
But the family is also underwater.
Yeah, it is. I mean, people can read lots of different things. I mean, one woman at a talkback, we're fortunate that we have talkbacks on some occasions, so we get to interact with the audience. And a lady the other day said, I found it interesting because water is usually something as healing and it is used as a cleansing thing. Here I felt it as a threatening force.
The title, if there is, I haven't found it yet, seems like the answer to a question. Do we ever find out what the question is?
I think it's different for every character and perhaps for everyone who enters the theatre. I mean, there's a tagline on the poster that says, how do we get out of this mess? Mm. Or what way do we get out of this mess?
I think that's what's nice about the staging of the play, and I think even in the writing of the play, that there's a sort of obtuse nature to the whole thing that I think that, particularly as an American audience, or I speak for myself when I say this, there's this desperation for a theme. You know, we're always looking for, it's the play about this, it's the play about that, this is what happens in the play. And I think what's brilliant about Nick's writing is that there is the theme is that there really is no theme. And in a way,
but yet I hope it's provocative.
Well, it is provocative in its nature.
It's as much about communication as anything else. Mm-hmm. You know, the difficulty of communicating with each other, even to the point where a cell phone plays a major part in the story. Mm-hmm. It's been extended for 2 weeks, but the schedule is a bit unusual, isn't it? You'll be taking 2 weeks off in late November and then resuming in early December for 2 more weeks?
Yeah.
Why is that? Did you have other commitments?
You know, Jake beforehand had to go to Europe to promote his movie End of Watch, which was we were supposed to finish earlier, and so that's something everyone else should. If you like watching actors really watch them in very different roles, you should either check out his End of Watch movie and then come see our play as well. It's a joy to watch an actor go to those different places.
Well, that's so nice. But I mean, yeah, it was. We were supposed to end and unfortunately had a sort of stop date at the end of November. And then just because of the joy the play has been and the fact that people have really responded to it and the fact that we all really want to continue to work together, we decided to extend it. And as a result, unfortunately, we have only after the 2 weeks of other work that we've all committed to. But yeah, it is an unusual schedule, but it is an unusual play, and I think it is within the same nature of the play itself that our schedule will be that way.
And what's next for you, Brian?
Well, you know, I'll never work again, Leonard. But you know, I would like
to say... Well, you've reached the high point of your career.
I would like to say this in totally...
After working with him, by the way, before he even finishes, I just want to say, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that that's true.
Thank you.
It's just such a pain to work with him. I don't know how to...
You know, I would like to say, just to him, because I know we're near the end, I live... The last number of years I've lived in Los Angeles, and I have a subscription to my local public radio. And there's nothing as good actually as I mean, it's great. I like listening to it. And when I was in New York City, I also contributed to public radio. And when you're driving along, it's great to listen to it. And all my favorite shows are always on public radio. Even podcasts that I listen to are on public radio. And there were a couple of years where I kind of put off joining. I go, oh, yeah, I must do that. Oh, maybe I'll do it in the next one. I didn't do that. But there's a great joy in knowing that you're part of keeping something as wonderful as this. And I have listened to your show for years, and I thoroughly enjoy it. And the same across the board on what everyone in this new wonderful building that you do. And so I would urge anybody who is just maybe just not putting it off. It's what gets me is I drink a latte every day and I'm going, how much does this latte cost? It's ridiculous. And the fact that I would feel much better not having lattes for 2 days and just knowing that my money went to you guys. So I just want to put that in.
We were both incredibly excited to be
honest. During our next fund drive, Brian, you have to come by and be my pitch partner.
Well, I'll quite willingly be it.
Meanwhile, we have...
He won't shave his beard.
If there is, I haven't found it yet, at the Laura Pell Theater at 111 West 46th Street. Thank you both so much, Brian F. O'Byrne and Jake Gyllenhaal, for being on our show.
Thanks for having us here.
Thanks for having us.